This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Ben Pornomo, who's the head of the CTOC at IBM.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. That's right. I'm the operational leader of the Cyber Tactical Operations Center, IBM's latest foray into incident response, part of a £155 million investment into incident response. This one is UK and Europe only. Cyber Tactical Operations Center is a vehicle. It's a truck that has a simulation center inside for cyber attack incident response. And the idea is to drive it all around Europe and bring the experience to people who can't make the trek to our cyber range in Boston. In Boston, Cambridge, Massachusetts, we have a cyber range that's like the Kobayashi Maru from the Wrath of Khan, the real Wrath of Khan, the first one. We took that and put it on a truck specifically made for Europe, so we don't have to plop one down any place and people have to travel. We'll bring the experience to them. The point of that is to put them through training in an operating room or in an ambulance for emergency services or a flight simulator where it's a safe environment where they can crash the plane, they can make mistakes, but they learn what it's like to be in a high-pressure situation to respond to a cyber attack. We're not in the midst of a cyber attack every day. They might happen slowly, but in our environment, in the CTOC, in the range on wheels, they unfold very quickly, very dramatically, and very immersively, and we get to bring that experience to large companies, public sector, all around Europe, starting here in the UK.
A lot of companies like to think they have disaster recovery plans. They like to think they can respond to a cyber attack. The reality, as we've seen all too often, is what they think they have, and when they actually have to implement it, there's a massive gap. Where do you start with the CTOC in helping them understand the gap and how to fix what is broken in their response?
The real mature parties in whatever kind of sector, industry, they have a plan. And then they know that they have to rehearse that plan, test it, swap out personnel, do it at appropriate intervals, and sometimes do it at random. But a good start is really having a plan. But then we have the cliche about like best laid plans. Where we come in is we will take plans that our participants have, analyze them with them, and get their specifications on how they would like to test that plan, how they would like to rehearse it, to identify gaps and weaknesses, measure performance against the procedures that a specific organization will run to respond, and go from there. Do that gap analysis. We start with tabletopping, move into wargaming, and then just repeat it.
There's an old military adage that the best laid plans never survive first contact with the enemy. Right. From an incident response perspective, no matter how much we think we've rehearsed it or we've worked with a plan, the moment that phone goes off, most people's plans start to unravel. When you're working with customers, those who've got plans and those who don't have plans, how open do you find they are to understanding that a lot of this is working on the fly? It's ability to react, not just having a hard script.
It's really variable depending on personality. There isn't an organization in the world that isn't personality driven. But the ones where you can identify those who know that no plan survives first contact is when you punch them in the face, they're able to take that blow and take a deep breath, remain calm, and actually execute their plan. We intentionally put our participants under stress. We intentionally punch them in the face. Depending on how the response goes and how people deal with adrenaline, there's a physiological reaction. You have glands that secrete different hormones, and you can't control that. Mm-hmm. Depending on your response, your physiological response, there's just a time where those hormone levels will decrease, and then you can get back to normal. But we intentionally try and stimulate that response. Those who are used to dealing with it, because they rehearse, because they've been in those pressure situations, that's the performance that we measure. But for those who aren't so used to those situations, we will try and wait till the adrenaline response subsides and then do after-action review, talk about best practices, talk about what went well and what might not have gone so well, how to improve, and move on from there.
We went through a scenario downstairs earlier today where you were explaining to people what to do, and then you started to raise the temperature in the middle of talking to people. Suddenly the phone starts ringing and the game is on. How much does that surprise people? Do they think you're just going to give them a lecture first and run through?
That's one of my tricks. So my trick is lull people to sleep. I'll play a really cheesy kind of onboarding video to have people really think, how tongue-in-cheek is this? Like, how immersive is this? And then I'll start lecturing in an academic way in order to lull people to sleep or maybe make them a little bored. And then it's on. That's how I get the surprise. Really, the element of surprise is key to what we do.
One of the things that was noticeable in the scenario was how you shifted the game. You picked different people in the room at different points with the phones ringing. And then at one point you had four conversations going simultaneously. It raises the noise level and it becomes very difficult sometimes to concentrate. How do people often react to that?
The most common reaction that we have is when those phones start ringing, you will see people, and we've taken pictures of push the phones away from them to somebody nearby. What else do people want to do? They just hang up. They'll hang up or take the phone off the hook. Because what is difficult to hear, it's difficult to pick up and record the details. Mm-hmm. When you're in an operational service, whether it's an armed forces or emergency services or whatever, if you're in customer service, you know that you have to record essential elements of information for every engagement. For people who aren't used to it, they're just not practiced in that. But we make it intentionally difficult as well by raising the sound level. Yeah, I'm giving away all trade secrets here, but we have little tricks to increase the difficulty level in the game.
Can you import, for example, a scenario a customer's had? One of the things with training is if people just run through an exercise, the question is always how much have they learned? So have you had customers say, look, we had a breach. We know what went wrong. We know what we did wrong. So you walk them through that so they can understand where the mistakes were, what they could have done better, and then you throw them into the game scenario. Is that something customers have asked about?
A more common situation is that any organization that's experienced a real serious breach or cyber attack, they may have fatigue on that situation. What they might want to do is take the lessons learned, because the framework for cyber resiliency is really a cycle. You come out at the end of response with lessons learned and then put them back at the beginning when you're at detect mm-hmm. and analyze stage. When people have experienced a really serious ransomware-like event, they normally have a lot of fatigue with that. What they'll want to do is hand over their runbook to us or their playbook or whatever their procedures are and design a scenario specifically to test certain business units, how well they follow that runbook.
The reason I ask the question is if I think about developers, the first thing a developer does when they change language is they take a program they've written and they rewrite it in the new language. Why? Because they know what the old one did, they know what they've done in the old one, and now they're looking to understand the differences. The problem with cyber is no two attacks are the same, but our response should be close enough that we have a timeline by which we know we're going to deal with things.
That's an interesting direction to go, because it's the tactics and techniques of the adversary are always different. There's always going to be different tools used in a different way. And then when you analyze the forensics, the IOCs are always a little bit different. But the thing that must change is that those technical indicators, those technical techniques can always change. But the response procedures of the technical team should remain the same. The technical remediation steps need to change with what the adversary is doing. But on a larger scale, to talk about a whole of organization response, rather than just that technical response, is where we see a lot of growth. We're using that developer analogy that we're just going to write a program in a new language because we know how it should perform and benchmark it against the previous performance of the old code. We have people who want to benchmark the performance of their team against like a real-world scenario, but usually the difference that we have is we bring in representatives from all parts of a company or a public sector organization. So instead of just having security operations center analysts and remediators and incident response team, the technical folks, who also will incorporate counsel or legal, who has to have oversight of the entire operation, depending on the severity, human resources personnel, communications and public relations personnel, finance representation is very important in a ransomware or disaster recovery situation because they're going to have to approve procurement stuff. And also leadership. Leadership is really critical because usually business leaders are used to performing in a certain kind of way. MBAs do business and conduct themselves in a steady state that when you move into emergency response and have to be operational, it's a paradigm shift. You can benchmark the performance of the technical teams in a new scenario, but the skill level of technical teams is really high. Is very high. But where we see the need is taking what the technical team is doing, sharing that information, reporting it to hire in a digestible way, where they can then understand that information and give out instructions and directions to the rest of the organization to respond to protect the other parts of the company.
So how often do customers give you a representative set of people? It's easy for them to send their security team down to work with you, but to then ask for the CISO or the CFO or the head of communications or somebody from legal, somebody from HR, somebody from finance, these are people they wouldn't necessarily think of in a game. To put them in there and take them out of their day job for an entire day so that they understand how those flows have to move must be quite challenging for customers.
It is challenging for customers because there's a cost. Everything that we do at no cost. But there's still a cost to everybody who wants to come, especially for those who need to travel to Boston. Right? They take an operational cost for people who aren't working. But the number of people and the seniority levels that participate kind of proves that there's a lot of value in that. But you also bring up a great point, and then there's a ton of work that goes into getting the right set of people into the room. And those are the unsung heroes of our operation. The people who do the education with potential participants and let them know, this is a valuable experience for you for a multidisciplinary team, and we want people from these different functional areas of this seniority level. It's successful because our participants do have the right participation.
Now, the advantage of the truck, of course, as you say, is rather than flying them into Boston, is you roll it to the premises. But the truck has two purposes, doesn't it? It's not just there to run a course for somebody. If you have a customer who's got an incident and they need to call on you, you can deploy that truck with your own team.
It's an operations center on demand. We can do disaster recovery, we can do analysis and forensics, we can do continuity of operations, or it could just be a command post, or a combination of all of those things. So we have the comms gear to do that, the comms gear that will be unsullied as the affected organization might be affected by ransomware or an APT. We have a data center, an environment that is also austere. So we can do sandboxing, tools testing, malware analysis in there as well. We also do forensics. But if you want to do continuity of operations, that will be available to you as well. It's just in a virtualized environment.
When you roll up to a site where a customer's got an attack in play, one of the challenges that I've seen is that customers write their plans, and the plans are all stored on the IT system, and then the IT system's inaccessible. How often do customers have a written version of their response requirements?
So I've only seen it once that there's a hard copy. But the problem is there's not a janitor or curator of that document. So in the case where there was a hard copy, it was 18 months old. So when we reviewed it, a lot of people referenced didn't even work at the company anymore. That's one thing we also test, another trade secret, is that we'll take the response plan in soft copy and then lock it down. We'll ransomware where it is, make it inaccessible. The lesson learned there is, hey, you have to have hard copies and they have to be up to date.
If I were to ask you to give me the four things that people need to actually have in mind as soon as an incident occurs, what are they?
One, you have to have a structure. You have to have a way to know what the situation is, to classify it and assign it a severity level. And once you have that, you need to have an organizational and management structure of that operation that's appropriate to your organization. And then that leadership team should issue the marching orders for that operation with the leadership intent. And that leadership intent should be able to have implied tasks that can be extracted all the way down as you go down the hierarchy of the organization. Two, then they have to have a plan, procedures, once you convene that incident management team or CCERT or whatever you want to call it. Once you convene that group and you have a severity level and a classification of an incident, there's a plan that everybody knows who is then responsible for reporting to work and what their duties are and what the nature of the work is, what the operation is, what finished looks like, and the time to get there. All of those parties know that they two critical things in the emergency or crisis is knowledge management and task management. So the number three is to have a platform for knowledge management and task management, whatever it is, whatever you can afford. Any kind of automation tooling you can have for knowledge management and task management will help the performance of the people who have to do their job and reduce the time and costs to complete the operation. The fourth thing I would say is you have to then, to the extent you can afford to, you can take the hit operationally and financially, rehearse those scenarios with some periodicity at least four times a year, and if you can, at random, to surprise people.
It would be nice to think that by the time we get to the end of this year, everybody's instant response is going to be so much better.
They ended 2019?
Yeah.
Oh, I guarantee it. We're going to fight in the server rooms, we're going to fight in the boardrooms, and we'll never give up until we get everyone's incident response better by 2020.
Ben, thank you.
Thanks, Ian.